Warning! The first portion of the following podcast contains adult language, sexual imagery, and some stuff to make you say, man, that's kind of a dirty play. Sorta. Skip to the 5-minute, 20-second mark. If easily offended, you have been warned. Well met, and welcome to episode 163, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 14th, 2018. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and in this podcast, we continue our discussion of The Tempest with a little bit of the body, a look at that sprite Ariel, and a dive into the play's epilogue. Let's start off with the body. So this is your final warning. If you are easily offended, skip to the 520 point in the podcast. Alrighty then. Since we have all the tender ears out of the room, it's time to check out the nudge-nudge wink-wink of The Tempest. Now, how much is there? Well, Eric Partridge, author of Shakespeare's Body, his wonderful discussion and dictionary of the risque in the Bard, says this play is, quote, by far the purest of the tragicomedies, and slightly milder than Twelfth Night. Of course, remember that Twelfth Night contains that wonderfully profane hidden spelling joke, so, you know, there's that. Interestingly enough, our first bit of the nasty comes from arguably the nicest guy in the play, Gonzalo, when he's discussing the bosun, whom he says is unlikely to drown, even if the boat he's on is, quote, as leaky as an unstaunched wench. My money's on the more disturbing of the two body interpretations here. The first one is as leaky as a woman on her period who isn't wearing an absorbent pad. Yeah, it's a disturbing mental image for you. The alternative is a sexually excited woman, which would get us to wet but leaky? I'm not sure female ejaculation was a thing in Shakespeare's day. Well, when Ariel and Prospero discuss the history of the isle and the foul witch Sycorax, Prospero explains about the one thing she did that removed the death sentence from her. She was pregnant, so that one thing was sex. Later in the same scene, we get more Caliban Sycorax stuff. Got by the devil himself upon thy wicked dam. More sex by Sycorax, though, this time specifically with the devil. Later, Prospero accuses Caliban of attempting to rape Miranda, or as he put it, seek to violate the honor of my child. When Miranda and Ferdinand have their meet-cute and instantly fall in love, Prospero notes that he must make this relationship a little more difficult to achieve, lest too light winning make the prize light. Here he's concerned that sexual promiscuity, the second light, is in store if she is won too easily, the first light. In the next scene, when Antonio and Sebastian are punning on what the others are saying, Sebastian uses the term subtle to denote an expertise in sex. In Act 2, Scene 2, Stefano's song references a tailor scratching her where she did itch. And if you think that means sex, you'd be right. Later in the scene, Stefano refers to Trinculo as the siege of this moon calf, asking his friend if he is the dump, siege Caliban left behind, and did Caliban shit or vent out Trinculo. When Miranda and Ferdinand speak to each other in Act 3, her speech is filled with unintentional innuendo. She talks of her desire, and all the more it seeks to hide itself, the bigger bulk it shows. So she knows that desire leads to sex, and sex to pregnancy, bigger bulk. And she speaks of her virginity, being a maid. And I think that these two bits of body are probably conscious. But her repeated use of dying, her dying, is probably a little more subtle and subconscious. Remember that dying was a metaphor for orgasm in Shakespeare's day. Caliban speaks of Miranda becoming Stefano's bed, or something for him to lie upon. Prospero warns Ferdinand against premarital sex with Miranda, the breaking of her virgin knot. During the wedding mask, Iris talks of Mars's hot minion, or Mars's lustful mistress. And really, that's about it. It feels like the play starts with some body, but then fades quickly. Maybe kind of like Shakespeare shot his wad early in this one. So, I've been doing some thinking. In The Tempest, just what is Ariel? In the name of the actors, we get Ariel as an airy spirit. Of course, relying on the names of the actors is, for me at least, an act fraught with dangers. They're editorial at best. But since Prospero himself uses the term in their first interaction, let's go with it. So what did spirit mean for Shakespeare and his audience? Well, most likely it was the third major definition that the Oxford English Dictionary has for being used during that period. A supernatural, incorporeal, rational being or personality, usually regarded as imperceptible at ordinary times to the human senses, but capable of becoming visible at pleasure, and frequently conceived as troublesome, terrifying, or hostile to mankind. And if The Tempest was a novel, I'd stop there. As this is a play, you know, with human actors, I'd probably append the third subpoint for that definition. A being of this nature imagined as possessing and actuating a person. I don't think we're dealing with the soul of a person, especially one that's just met his maker, so that dictionary definition is out of the way, though that might make for an interesting take on the play. Anyway, incorporeal, imperceptible, until it shows up. I keep looking at the text. Is there a time when Ariel is seen by someone other than Prospero? I know. Ferdinand, Caliban, and the drunks can hear Ariel, but actually see it? I don't think so. I'd assume that Sycorax could see it as well. How else could she imprison Ariel in that tree? And if that's the case, why just these two? Why doesn't Caliban see it? Is Ariel magic? Witchcraft? I don't know. What I do think is possible is the use of the first major spirit definition, the animating or vital principle in man and animals, that which gives life to physical organism in contrast to its purely material elements, the breath of life. Is Ariel actually a part of Prospero, a kind of essence? Is his release of the spirit the reason why his every third thought shall be of his grave? Was Sycorax's imprisonment of Ariel in the tree the same kind of retirement from magic that we see Prospero reach at the end of the play? Or am I just overthinking this? Is Ariel like Tinkerbell, who lives on the belief of the audience? After all, I would say that if you don't buy Ariel, the entire production is probably toast. Which raises the last questions. How the heck do you portray Ariel on stage? Flying? Is not really there? The RSC's recent production made major use of on-the-fly computer-generated imagery. Is that how you do it? Because it wasn't for Shakespeare. Shakespeare fans, need a poster to hang in your room? Teachers, need some nifty handouts for your students to peruse as you introduce them to the Bard? Or are you just in the mood for some printable versions of some of the cool infographics found on this website? Well, regardless of how you answered those questions, I've got a scratch for that itch, a solution for that problem. Check out the Bill Shakespeare Project page on the Teachers Pay Teachers website. You can find character maps for Romeo and Juliet and Julius Caesar previewing the characters and their relationships to one another. I've also got geographical maps so your students can wrap their heads around travels within the plays Troilus and Cressida. Yes, even TNC gets some love. All's Well That Ends Well as well. See what I did there? Plus Pericles and Othello. There's also handouts on the so-called history in Macbeth and Julius Caesar, time in Romeo and Juliet, and violence in Titus Andronicus. Also, you'll find entire packets of handouts for both King Lear and Macbeth, including scene-by-scene timelines and the interactions as well as relationships between the characters. And I'll be adding even more soon. Plus, this is where you can find the printable version of the new and improved periodic table of Shakespeare. Some of these are for free, and some are for purchase, but all can be found on the Bill Shakespeare Project page on teacherspayteachers.com. Oh, and if you want to purchase a pre-printed poster-sized version of that periodic table, well then head on over to the Bill Shakespeare Project page on redbubble.com. Links to both of these sites can be found in the left-hand margin of this website. Okay, a couple of quick thoughts, well, maybe not so quick, on the epilogue to The Tempest. Epilogue, spoken by Prospero. Now my charms are all o'erthrown, and what strength I have's mine own, which is most faint. Now 'tis true I must be here confined by you, or sent to Naples. Let me not, since I have my dukedom got, and pardon the deceiver, dwell in this bare island by your spell, but release me from my bands with the help of your good hands. Gentle breath of yours my sails must fill, or else my project fails, which was to please. Now I want spirits to enforce, art to enchant, and my ending is despair unless I be relieved by prayer, which pierces so that it assaults mercy itself and frees all faults. As you from crimes would pardoned be, let your indulgence set me free. Of course, the opening three lines of the speech have many believing that this is some kind of valedictory speech, a kind of goodbye from the bard. But I don't want to talk about that, not just this second. I want to hit upon something else. There are only five plays in the canon that we've read that end with an epilogue. Second part of Henry IV, Henry V, Pericles, As You Like It, and this one, The Tempest. Now, the first three have that last speech spoken by some kind of choric figure, Rumor, Chorus, Gower, respectively. As You Like It is spoken by Rosalind, in air quotes, but it's obvious that it's really the actor speaking the lines as he says, if I were a woman. So it's not the character. So that leaves this as the only epilogue spoken by a character in the play. Stop! I know what some of you are thinking. But what about that ending of Midsummer Night's Dream? What about Puck/Robin's last speech? Well, in that play, everyone but Puck exits before his speech, leaving him alone on stage. So it's less an epilogue than more a final speech. In this play, everyone including Prospero exits, and then we get the epilogue with the weirdly specific stage direction spoken by Prospero. So enough with that Midsummer stuff. And yet, look at the speech. That's not blank verse, my friends. Nope. The lines rhyme, the speech is in couplets. And look at, you know where this is going, the scansion. The lines are short, but more than that, they're sing-songy. An incomplete or catalytic form of trochaic tetrameter, perhaps. Trochees, as you might remember, are the exact opposites of iambs. Instead of a two-syllable foot with the first syllable unstressed and the second syllable stressed, a trochee is a two-syllable foot with the first syllable stressed, the last one unstressed. Tetrameter would be comprised of four-foot lines, so eight syllables. But these lines are, for the most part, seven-syllable affairs, and that's where the catalytic descriptor comes into play. Instead of a full trochee at the end of the line loses that final unstressed syllable. So you could call these lines catalytic trochaic tetrameter. Or you might call them acephalous iambic tetrameter. In other words, this would be a four-foot iambic line, only we're missing the first syllable. Regardless, this is the same kind of incantatory verse that we see in The Witches in Macbeth, and, you guessed it, the fairies in Midsummer. Witchcraft, fairies, magic, supernatural, that works here. So maybe there is a Midsummer connection here. Only the verse is really a mess. Yes, we have some acephalous iambic tetrameter, but we have also some plain old iambic tetrameter as well. Of the 20 lines in the speech, only 7 are acephalous, 9 are pretty solid iambic, which leaves 4 to be just plain funky. Is the messiness of this speech's scansion supposed to be a representation of Prospero's overthrown charms and most faint strength? Or is there something at work here? Is it a valedictory? Is it a goodbye for Shakespeare? There is a palpable sense of ending in the speech. Overthrown charms, faint strength, failing projects, endings of lost hope. I suppose that is one reason for seeing this as a valedictory. There is certainly a feeling of the speaker begging for release, pleading for a merciful end of his trials. He cannot go on. He's spent. He lacks wants, spirits, and art. And without that, his project will ultimately fail. And remember, his project, his goal was to please. This sounds to me like an artist at the end. And those first three lines are certainly grist for discussion. His power is now just his own strength, which is faint. What had been there before, but has now been knocked to the ground, or thrown, charms. Of course, in a play about magic, the first assumed meaning here for charms is that of spells, as noted in the Oxford English Dictionary. but there is a specific element to the main meaning of the word that begs to be noted. The chanting or recitation of a verse supposed to possess magic power or occult influence. Incantation, enchantment, verse, Shakespeare's superpower. And in this last speech, that verse is a mess. So is this epilogue's failed verse true, or is it just a play on words, a kind of meta-reference to his own failings? And here, maybe, for a moment, I become a bardolator. I don't think this faulty verse is real. I think he's doing this on purpose, for the purpose of telling us, hell, showing us, how great he is, or at least was. He's going out on his own terms, terms of his devising and defining. This is the last play he'll write solo. It's been a great run, but it's over. There's a part of me that wants to doubt that he'd be so heavy-handed, so offhandedly flashy and arrogant. But remember how many of his sonnets talk about how they will live forever. So I don't think the whole play is a valedictory, at least not in a hey, look at me way. But this epilogue? Yeah, I think there's a bit of that going on. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast, but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entry since our last regular podcast, and that was just a week ago. Can you believe that? You've missed out on subjects including, it's a short list, Friday Non-Film Focus, A Question of Post-Colonialism, The Tempest, by the numbers, The Sprightly Voice of Conscience, Humanity, Friday Non-Film Focus, Othello, and Production Questions. So, if you would like more in-depth discussions or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com or become a fan of our Facebook page or Twitter feed. Remember that those social media outlets are more for Shakespeare news and notes than for discussions of our current play under study. Also, if you have any question or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And join us again for our next podcast, when we will conclude our discussion of The Tempest with a wrap-up, a cast, and, you know, our usual stuff. Hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for January 14th, 2018. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. And we shall see thee anon.